Yashoda Nandana Raja Janarandana Yamuna Tira Yashodanandana Raja Janarandana Yamuna Tira Thank you. Prabhupada, Jaya Prabhupada, Jaya Prabhupada. Jaya Prabhupada, Jaya Prabhupada, Jaya Prabhupada, Jaya Prabhupada. Jaya Prabhupada, Jaya Prabhupada, Jaya Prabhupada, Jaya Prabhupada. Jai Om Vishnu Bhad Paramahansa Paribhajika Charja Stotra Sara Shri Shri Mahara Sabhain Gai Shri Bhakti Siddhanta Saraswati Kato Mahara Shri Prabhupada Ki Jai Ananda Goti Vaishnava Vrinda Ki Jai Nistan Founder Acharya Shri Prabhupada Ki Jai Namacharya Shri Haridas Thakur Ki Jai Prem Sagosri Krishna Chaitanya Prabhu Nityananda Shri Adoita Gadara Shri Vasadi Gaur Bhakta Vrinda Ki Jai Shri Shri Radha Krishna Gopinath Shyam Kundara Rikundi Giri Govardhan Ki Jai Shri Shri Vrindavan Dham Ki Jai Shri Shri Navarit Dham Ki Jai Shri Shri Mayapur Dham Ki Jai Shri Shri Mathura Dham Ki Jai Tulasi Devi Ki Jai Bhakti Devi Ki Jai Ganga Maya Ki Jai Jamuna Maya Ki Jai Gaur Premanandi Hari Nama Sankirtan Ki Jai Shri Shri Brihat Madanga Ki Jai Transcendental Prasadam Distribution Ki Jai Shri Shri Gornitai Ki Jai Shri Shri Taram Lakshman Hanuman Ki Jai Shri Shri Radhamadana Mahana Ki Jai Shri Shri Hastinapura Dhamma Ki Jai Shama Veta Bhakta Vrinda Ki Jai. All glories to the assembled devotees. All glories to the assembled devotees. All glories to the assembled devotees. All glories to Shri Shri Guru and Shri Gauranga. Reading from Srila Prabhupada Lilamrita by His Holiness Satsarupa Das Goswami from every town and village. With Prabhupada's first success in America, a few of his godbrothers in India had minimized his work. Bhaktivedanta Swami, they had said, happened to have a temperament suited to mixing with lower class Western youth. The fact, however, as Prabhupada's own experience testified, was that the young people among whom he preached, were not particularly receptive, nor had he arrived timely and welcome simply to discourse on Srimad Bhagavatam to throngs of submissive disciples. He had been successful because of his great patience, tolerance, and compassion. It was not, therefore, the advent of the jet plane, although Prabhupada gladly took advantage of it, nor was it happenstance, nor luck, nor even a social or historical phenomenon that enabled Srila Prabhupada to spread Vedic culture from east to west and back again. No, it was the will of Krishna and the sincerity of his servant. Chaitanya Chaitamrita states that one who is possessed of Krishna Shakti, special power from God, unless one is so possessed, one cannot propagate the chanting of the holy name. Kali Kalera Dharma Krishna Nama Sankirtana Krishna Shakti Vina Nahi Tari Prapatana. The fundamental religious system in the age of Kali is the chanting of the holy name of Krishna. Unless empowered by Krishna, one cannot propagate the Sankirtan movement, Chaitanya Chaitamrita Antyalila, 7th chapter, 11th verse. This verse, describing Lord Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, also describes Lord Chaitanya's servant, Srila Prabhupada. Had Srila Prabhupada not been empowered by Krishna, he could not have inspired so many people to accept the chanting of Hare Krishna. According to Vedic literature, when a person has extraordinary spiritual endowment, Krishna Shakti, he is known as a Shaktivesha avatar. Although the word avatar generally refers to incarnations of God himself, the term Shaktivesha avatar refers to an individual empowered by God to enact the mission of God in this world. Shaktivesha avatars and their particular functions are mentioned in the Vedic literature. For example, the Emperor Prithu possessed the Shakti for God-conscious administration. The four Kumaras possessed the Shakti of transcendental knowledge. And Narada Muni possessed the Shakti of devotional service. Lord Buddha, whose name and activities are described in Srimad Bhagavatam, is also a Shaktivesha avatar. And even other divinely empowered personalities outside the Vedic culture, such as Jesus Christ and Muhammad, are accepted by Vaishnava Acharyas as Shaktivesha avatars. Srila Prabhupada's activities during the years 1968 through 1971 establish him as a Shaktivesha avatar, and he fulfills the predictions of the scriptures, Priti Vite Ache Jata Nagarari Gram, Sarvatra Pachara Hoive Morinam. In all the villages and towns all over the world, everywhere, the Sankirtan movement of Lord Chaitanya will be preached. Even from the viewpoint of religious history, Prabhupada's preaching was a fulfillment of the mission of Lord Chaitanya, who had appeared in West Bengal about 500 years before Krishna consciousness came west. The Vedic literature and the Vaishnavacharyas concur that Lord Chaitanya is the original Supreme Personality of Godhead, Krishna himself, appearing in this age as a pure devotee of the Lord. And just as Lord Krishna appeared with his plenary expansion, Lord Balaram, Lord Chaitanya appeared with Balaram's incarnation for Kali Yuga, Lord Nityananda. So I'll read one more paragraph. Srila Prabhupada can be appreciated not only generally as the empowered representative of God, but specifically as the manifestation of Lord Nityananda. According to Gaudiya Vaishnava philosophy, Lord Krishna manifests himself to the souls of ordinary men through Lord Nityananda. The individual soul requires the help of God to realize God. This help comes by the mercy of Lord Nityananda, who is therefore known as the original Guru. Although Lord Nityananda is a direct expansion of Lord Chaitanya, his pastime is to serve Lord Chaitanya by redeeming the fallen souls. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Rayanam Namaskritam Naram Chaivam Narottamam Devim Saraswatim Vyasam Dato Jaya Mudirayat Nasta Prayeshu Abhadreshu Nityam Bhagavata Sevaya Bhagavati Uttama Shloke Bhakti Bhavati Naishtiki. We're reading from Srila Prabhupada's Translations and Purports, 4th Canto, 7th Chapter, Text Number 5. Vahubhyam Ashvino Pushno Hastabhyam Krita Bhava Bhavanti Pavantya Varyavash Chanye Vasta Shmashru Rigur Bhavet Bahu Bhyamashvino Pushno Bahu Bhyamashvino Pushno Astabhyam Krita Bahava Hastabhyam Krita Bhava Bhavantvad Varayas Chanye Bhavantvad Varayas Chanye Vastashmashu Brigur Bhavet Vastashmashu Brigur Bhavet Bahu Bhyamashvino Pungshno Astabhyam Krita Bhava Bhavantvad Varay Bhavantvad Varyavas Chanye Pasta Smarshu Brigur Bhavet Bahu Bhyamashvino Pushno Astabhyam Krita Bhava Pavan Padvarya Vastanye Vastashma Shubrigur Bhavet. Bahubhyam Ashvino Pushno Astabhyam Krita Bhava Bhavantvadvarya Vashchanye Vastasma Shubrigur Bharet Bahubhyam Ashvino Pushno Astabhyam Krita Bahava Bhavan Padvarya Vashchanye Vastashmashu Brigur Bhavit Bahubhyam Ashvino Pushno Vastabhyam Krita Bahava Bhavan Padvarya Vashchanye Vasta Smashu Brigur Bhave Manaji's face. Bahubhyam Ashvino Pushno Kastabhyam Krita Bhava Bhavan Padvarya Vashchanye Vasta Smashur Brigur Bhave. Bahubhyam Ashvino Pushno Hastabhyam Krita Bahava Bhavan Padvarya Vashchanye Vasta Smashur Brigur Bhave. Bahubhyam, with two arms. Ashvino, of Ashvini Kumar. Pushna, of Pusha. Astabhyam, with two hands. Krita Bhava, those in need of arms. Bhavantu, they will have to. Advarayava, the priests, cha, and anye, others, vastashmarshu, the beard of the goat, brigu, brigu, habit, he may have. Translation, Srila Prabhupada. Those who have had their arms cut off will have to work with the arms of Ashwini Kumar. And those whose hands were cut off will have to do their work with the hands of Pusha. The priest will also have to act in that manner. As for Brigu, he will have the beard from the goat's head. Purport by Srila Prabhupada. Brigu Muni, the great supporter of Daksha, was awarded the beard of the goat's head, which was substituted for the head of Daksha. It appears from the exchange of Daksha's head that the modern scientific theory that the brain substance is the cause of all intelligent work is not valid. The brain substance of Daksha and that of the goat are different, but Daksha still acted like himself, even though his head was replaced by that of a goat. The conclusion is that it is the particular consciousness of an individual soul which acts. The brain substance is only an instrument which has nothing to do with real intelligence. Real intelligence, mind and consciousness are part of the particular individual soul. It will be found in the verses ahead that after Daksha's head was replaced by the goat's head, he was as intelligent as he had previously been. He prayed very nicely to satisfy Lord Shiva and Lord Vishnu, which is not possible for a goat to do. Therefore, it is definitely concluded that the brain substance is not the center of intelligence. It is the consciousness of a particular soul that works intelligently. The whole movement of Krishna consciousness is to purify the consciousness. It doesn't matter what kind of brain one has, because if he simply transfers his consciousness from matter to Krishna, his life becomes successful.
It is confirmed by the Lord Himself in Bhagavad Gita that anyone who takes up Krishna consciousness achieves the highest perfection of life, regardless of whatever abominable condition of life he may have fallen into. Specifically, anyone in Krishna consciousness goes back to Godhead, back to home, on leaving his present material body.
Om Ginati Minandasya Gananjana Salakaya Chakshurun Militam Jaina Tasmai Shri Gurave Namaha Sri Chaitanya Manobhistam Stapitam Jaina Bhutale Swayam Rupa Karamayam Dadati Svaparam Sikam.
Prabhupada is making it clear that despite the change in parts of the body, even a brain, that the individual soul remains the same. There was a discussion with Prabhupada and some surgeon who was making heart transplants, and that question arose that if the soul resides in the heart and the heart is transplanted, then someone gets another soul from the other heart, or the old soul goes away. And Prabhupada's answer was that the soul stays the same, stays in that particular body, and he compared it to an individual who lives in a house or an apartment, moving from one place to another. Even though that house or that apartment is the habitat of that particular individual, that individual might move from one place to another. So the soul stays in that particular body, even though the heart may be transplanted. Now more and more organs are being transplanted. Maybe they'll even transplant a brain sometime. It's becoming more and more popular in research and in surgical operations, organs, kidneys, livers, spleens, hearts. I don't know if anyone's lived very long from a heart transplant. Maybe they have. The first one didn't live, Barney somebody or other. But I think they're improving, and they'll probably be able to do things like that. And so here's the very dramatic example. We see the picture of Daksha with the head of a goat, and he's remembering his past life. Planting pigs' hearts in human beings. Yeah, that's another thing that I've heard, that they're making these interspecial, I don't know what the word is, transplants from animals to humans. Prabhupada talked about this. There was one gentleman, I guess you could call him that, from some place near where Prabhupada came, who wanted to have more potent sexual potency. So he had the doctor surgically implant the testicles of a monkey on him. Actually happened. This was quite a while ago. I don't know what the result was. But, you know, these kinds of things are not so uncommon. They happen. There was about 15 years ago at a university near Los Angeles, it was Loma Linda, one of these, happens to be a Seventh-day Adventist hospital, progressive, and they're supposed to be vegetarians, I think they are. Anyway, they implanted the baboon heart into a baby, a newly born infant, because it was destined to not live or something, because of a weak heart. So they actually did this, and I was in England at the time, and it was characterized as a Frankenstein operation. You know, Frankenstein, put all these different parts together and created so on. Anyway, this infant only lived for about 4 or 5 days after the baboon's heart was planted and transplanted into it. Anyway, they're getting more and more sophisticated. And, you know, these are just like parts of a car. When the fuel pump goes out, you put a new one in. When the engine goes out, you put a new one in. And so it's medical science is getting more sophisticated and able to actually transplant organs of humans, non-humans, and others so that they actually work. And but these things were known a long time ago. They weren't so considered so miraculous. They were almost like, you know, people didn't think that they were something that was high sci-fi or something wonderful or miraculous. But it was understood the soul could move freely from one place to another. The soul actually doesn't depend on the body, but the body depends on the soul. There's no life in the body without the soul. That's the difference, and that's what Prabhupada, the substance was of this conversation that Prabhupada had with this surgeon. And he agreed with Prabhupada that basically because you have the same individual, even though you might change the heart. And here he's even talking about the brain, which people think is the center of consciousness. That, the empiricists, they generally believe that the brain of a human being is can answer all of the questions. They studied Einstein's brain after he passed away. They dissected it and they tried to figure out why he was so intelligent and so on, why he figured so many things out. Actually, one of the interesting things about his thinking process, I read recently in the Times of India, is that he was actually believing that there was a transcendent reality that he called God. He didn't have the personal conception of God, but he believed that people should be humble. He believed that his gifts were very slight compared to many other people who might be as gifted as he was. He felt that people were too proud. He thought that it was obscene that he was glorified so much in human society, and that he felt that people should be humble and offer things to God. It was very interesting that even though he amassed all his learning, he maintained a certain humility. And he didn't think that it was his brain that had all the answers. He thought that the answers, the solutions, the ultimate reality rested elsewhere outside the human brain. So the soul, it's mentioned in the Bhagavad Gita, is immutable, it's unchangeable, it can't be killed by weapons, it can't be destroyed, it's eternal. It's also mentioned that just as the Supreme Godhead is eternal, so the soul has an eternal nature. It cannot be destroyed, it has no beginning, it has no end. There are also different instances of, in the modern day, they sometimes hypnotize people and get them to remember a time, they say, when they were in another body, when their soul was in another body. And some research has done this without hypnosis, and they've proven that such things really existed by going to the places that people remember under hypnosis or in deep memory and verified the facts that they mentioned. And in many cases, these are indications, strong indications, that the soul in that particular person inhabited another body at another time, in another place, in another completely different body. Sometimes it was a male who was a female in the past life, and so on. Of course, most of that that's going on is probably mumbo-jumbo and superstitious and used to make money and so on. But there have been instances that are proven to the point where they're hard to deny. So there's the case of Bharata Maharaj, who, as we know in Bhagavad Gita, whatever we're thinking at the time of death, it determines our next body. When he met his death, he was in deep meditation on a deer. So he became a deer. And throughout the course of that lifetime, as an animal, he was able to remember clearly the past life. And therefore, deers can't live a very complicated life, but prepared for a next body. And the next body, of course, was Judd Bharat, where there was also remembrance. And Judd Bharat was so conscious of the mistakes made of that soul, that individual in previous bodies, that he decided to limit all intercourse with the outside world and just constantly meditate on the Supreme Lord. And therefore didn't talk to anyone, didn't protest when he was dragged away to be killed, and just lived like a blind, dumb, unintelligent person. Didn't have any brain to think. And yet he was a highly advanced personality, very, very advanced. These are all kind of curses that are being meted out here by Lord Shiva, but they're not exactly the same kinds of punishments that occur in. There are different types of punishments. There's one type of punishment that's just for the main purpose of stopping someone, like they're put in jail so that they can't go out and commit more crimes, or they're killed so that they can't kill more people. And these are considered under the laws of Manu. There's even I think in the Manu Samhita, you can correct me if I'm wrong, there's strictures about how there's different punishments for different things. And as I remember rightly, the punishment for stealing is cutting off hands. So it seems rather severe, but that's actually what is considered to be the just punishment for taking something that doesn't belong to you. And one of the practical effects of this is that people, when they see that a thief's hands have been cut off, they won't want to steal again. Nowadays, if they're for stealing, they might get a fine, they get put in jail for a little while, then they're out again stealing, generally. But if someone's hands are cut off, That's pretty heavy. I mean, you'd see someone's hands cut off for stealing, you don't want to steal again. So these have very practical applications. I think in some parts of the world they still practice some of these things. At least I've heard in Iran that they cut off people's arms for stealing. Maybe they go a little bit beyond the hands, but they're still doing it anyway. And it creates a sense of law and order. That's, in one way, it's admirable that people don't steal.
Hmm?
In China, they execute them. Yeah. Yeah. In America, they think that these other places are cruel and so on. But actually, in one sense, they're a little bit closer to the laws of Manu, the law of karma. In Singapore, they arrested an 18-year-old American boy for spray painting a car with graffiti, and the punishment there is that they what they call caning. You know, it sounds like you just have a little cane, you know, like you walk around with and you beat him on the buttocks. But actually, it's about 3 inches in diameter, soaked in water overnight. And the guy that hits you with it is pretty, you know, about 300 pounds. And it's not just one or two times. It's, you know, people go unconscious from the pain. It's very painful. But again, it acts as a deterrent. It's considered to be very primitive and brutal and barbarian in this country. And President Clinton even contacted the president of Singapore and asked him to release this poor American boy for defacing someone's car and so forth and so on. But it definitely works in the sense that it deters that kind of crime. I mean, whatever it is, vandalism or whatever they do, it has its good side. Anyway, there are different types of punishment. So one type is to just punish, and it's called containment. I think they call it containment, where you're just locked up and you can't commit the crime. And another one is more on the realm of reform, where the punishment has with it a desire to stop the person from doing it again, and to right this person and get him on the or her on the correct path. So this type of punishment being meted out by Lord Shiva is more like that. It's more reformatory. And in general, of course, all punishment is from the Vedic point of view is meant to reform, just like our incarceration in this material world. There's a purpose behind it of reform, and that reform purpose is that we'll realize that it's not the place for a civilized person to be, and we'll want to act in such a way that we won't have to continue to take birth in this material world. We'll purify ourselves and we'll qualify ourselves to get away from this unfortunate situation. So it's a kind of, the material world, in addition to being a prison, is a kind of reform. When I was a kid, we used to talk about kids not going to reform school and not jail. If you were a kid, you didn't go to jail, you went to reform school. And of course now I think you have to go to jail because there's so many murders taking place among young people. But that's the idea, and it's really supposed to be the idea. The whole system, the whole penal system, is to reform people, make them good citizens. I think one of the things Prabhupada talks about in this chapter, if I'm not mistaken, is how Daksha was a kind of symbolic or metaphoric representation of a certain type of situation where he was beheaded and his head was burned. Prabhupada talks about society is kind of like this nowadays. It's kind of headless. It doesn't have a truly brahminical feature to it, which is guiding, directing, counseling along spiritual principles, as it was the case when the Rajarishis were in power. But it's sort of running along. Like when they slaughter chickens, they continue to run. Well, he compared society like that, that it's just sort of running on without any direction, without any head, without any spiritual vision. The brahminical element in society is supposed to direct, just like the head on the body, it's supposed to direct everything. It's the brain, it's the center, the nerve center. It goes up through the back of the spine, through the neck. So that's supposed to be the way society is ruled. And without a proper thought, without proper guidance, without proper counsel from the Supreme Being, without that darshan and constant remembrance, then society is in a very dangerous condition. It reminds me of that picture in the Bhagavad Gita, the chariot of the body, how this carriage is careening very precariously on the edge of the precipice, of the cliff, about to fall into the precipice. So sometimes we wonder, actually, at least as devotees, I sometimes wonder, how society can even continue. I mean, it works. People get on buses and the cars are all going down the beltway and you know, the television stations are all working. But in another way, you know, even though things are going on schedule and so on, when one considers the level of sinful activity that's going on and the lack of a centeredness in society, it sort of makes you wonder, at least for me, why people aren't just, you know, fighting like cats and dogs, and why there's any semblance of any order at all in society. So this is just speculation, but sometimes I think it's only because the Sankirtan movement is vibrating pure spiritual vibrations in the air. There's a thread of order in society. Of course, like I said, maybe that's speculation, but definitely it has a positive influence. Just like we think that, you know, maybe our efforts had some influence in at least temporarily holding this bill that would restrict Krishna conscious activities in Russia back, or maybe it was the straw that broke the camel's back or something like that. So anytime there's an infraction, like in a sacrifice, it may start out as a very small offense, maybe unknowing or insignificant. It can escalate. And in Kali Yuga, everything can escalate very rapidly. It is stated that in the age of quarrel, people will get in a little quarrel over some insignificant thing. And that very insignificant thing, like you blocked the door, or you know, you stepped on my foot or something like that, can escalate into a big feud. And that big feud can escalate into a national war and so on. And if you look at the last few wars, it's sort of like they start on by incidents, what they call incidents. There's a little incident, and then somebody doesn't like it, and then pretty soon you have a polarization, and groups are forming, and the next thing you know, there's communities, and then there's countries, and then they're getting into a big battle or a big war. This can be avoided by avoiding the kind of offense that was committed here, where the actual enjoyer of all things, all work, all effort, all endeavor is really meant to be Krishna, the Supreme Lord, not someone else. And this is the root, in one way, of our false ego, my thinking that I did this so I should get that, or someone insulted me so I have to insult back twice as hard. And this is kind of what happened here when this sacrifice was frustrated. We could see all the false egos coming up, that, you know, tit for tat, a tooth for a tooth, an eye for an eye. Everything had to be sort of equaled out. And finally, Lord Vishnu comes into the scene later on here and has to sort of mollify everything and present the real truth, that there's one single person who is the head of everyone else, and that all fealty, all oath, all obligations, all sacrifices, all enjoyment is actually meant for his enjoyment. And when Lord Vishnu appears in the arena, then people begin to gradually come to their senses and realize that they've ultimately offended Vishnu. So if we offend Vishnu's servants or anyone, if we don't sort of let people kind of have their rightful share, which is not really very much, by encroaching on others' property, Prabhupada said this is the essence of all conflict, then there is a kind of retribution that comes from the higher order laws of the universe. And as it is said, Lord Vishnu, Lord Krishna comes personally to correct things when they get really out of hand. Pritranaya sadunam vina chaya chadushkritam. And in the case of the Kurukshetra war and other cases, sometimes there's great annihilations. Of course, Prabhupada said that the present wars are taking place for demonically minded people to annihilate one another, because these are kind of insignificant things compared to the level that they got to under before the Kurukshetra war was fought. One of the ways that we learn from this incident that everything is ultimately depending on Lord Krishna is that all of the great leaders in the higher planetary systems, including Lord Shiva and Lord Brahma, they're all beholden to Krishna for their sustenance. Lord Brahma was born from Lord Krishna, Lord Shiva was born from Lord Brahma, that they all come from him, that they all pay their obeisances to him. Prabhupada mentions somewhere in the Bhagavatam that in even a lot of the temples, the Vishnu temples, there are demigods in those temples. And in the Jagannath temple, he mentions there's a deity of Lord Shiva, and there's also a deity of Lakshmi. Even in the Bhuvaneshwar temple, which is a Shiva temple, if I'm not mistaken, Lord Shiva is offered the prasad of Lord Vishnu. And in the Jagannath temple, Lord Shiva and Lakshmi Devi are offered the prasad of Lord Jagannath. So it's kind of like in a family, you know, there's a family head, and at least in the beginning, all the children are dependent upon the support of the father, of the parents. The father's the head of the family. So Lord Vishnu is like that, Vishnu Tattva. He's the head, and all of the different 33 lakhs, is it, of demigods? It's 33 million demigods, 330 lakhs. They're all dependent on the direction, the mercy, the intelligence of the Supreme Lord. So all of their meditation, all of their effort is due to His mercy alone. And later on we'll see how Lord Vishnu comes into the arena and accepts the obeisances of everybody there. So we'll stop here. Any comments or questions? Oh, I was going to mention about New Vrindavan. Some devotees were asking me. Anutu and I, representing the communications wing of ISKCON, met with Bhakti Tirth Maharaj, Radhanath Maharaj, who are the GBCs for West Virginia, not New Vrindavan yet. And there was Varshana Maharaj. There's another Swami, I don't remember his name. Rajashekhar, maybe. And then the sort of leaders of New Vrindavan. There was about 25 or so people. And the meeting was about how to, and if to, reintegrate New Vrindavan into ISKCON, because all of the Christian trappings are no longer present, and it's become, you know, for all intents and purposes, a regular ISKCON temple. It became very strange for a while. So, since that's been going on, culmination of the final determinations were, first of all, that New Vrindavan would be studied for 1 year, and during this 1 year, it would not be a member of the ISKCON body. It would do what it usually does, raise funds also for the temple, which is in a state, the palace, which is in a bit of a state of decay, receive visits from ISKCON devotees and leaders regularly, and they would visit others. They would get all their legal problems more further in order, and we would hope to see that there's no complaints, I mean, legitimate, genuine, deep complaints emanating from their neighbors or the local county and government and so forth. So that would be a kind of a period of study. And there was one corporation that was using ISKCON's name, so they've agreed to consult with their lawyers and see if they can remove the ISKCON name from that corporation. It's a bit complicated, but they think they may be able to do it. They're going to make the effort. So there's a number of things like that. It's all been made in letter. And that letter is an application to be readmitted into ISKCON. That letter will be formulated and made public. And then ISKCON will formally respond to that letter after a few weeks, also publicly. So that'll be and it'll be based on this idea that everybody has agreed, both sides, to have a year of study. And then if all the conditions are met, as laid out in those letters, within the year's time, then New Vrindavan will be admitted into ISKCON after 1 year's time on a conditional or provisional basis. And that provisional rider will remain in effect for 2 years. That is, after 1 year, after the first year of probation, which means the second year from now, it can have its instatement or integration renewed based on good performance record. And then at the end of that, the next year, which would be the third year from now, the second year of probation, provided all the conditions are met, then it can be fully admitted as a full-fledged member of the ISKCON body. So that's what happened, basically, in a nutshell. The mood was very positive, very good. And when this idea of a one-year study period came up, there were a couple of doubts about it, some objections. So Radhanath Maharaj asked all the devotees who were at the meeting who lived in New Vrindavan what they thought, and one by one they spoke. And all of them, it was unanimous, agreed that they would accept that as suitable, that the 1 year study period would be acceptable. So then there was a consensus on that point overall. Okay. So I think we have a little time. Yeah, I'm sorry I didn't mention that was a very major topic. that all financial matters would be brought into.